I'm going to take some time now and outline briefly what we're going to be listening to on the program. Now, tonight's broadcast, we're going to download some more information concerning into the archives. Basically, I'm going to read some very critical information concerning the evolution of Japanese fascism, how fascism came to Japan in the 1920s and 30s, the forces that were behind it, and its relevance for our world today. I think people are going to find this very stimulating, very frightening, very useful. And for people who would like to understand the Japan of today, the Japan of yesterday, the connections between the two and their relevance for to the United States of yesterday and the United States of today, the archival material that's going to be presented this evening will prove absolutely critical. I think people are going to find this very, very stimulating. So again, the archives are specifically intended for taping off the air. So if you are in a position to do so, I strongly encourage the listening audience to tape the broadcast this evening, because a large section of it is going to go permanently into the archives. It deals with Japanese fascism. We wind up talking mostly about German and Native American fascism on this program. The subject of Japanese fascism has not come up as often. It will be front and center during much of the broadcast this evening. Then we're going to take a look at a couple of books from the 1940s, actually during the Second World War, that are going to reveal some key aspects of Japanese fascism and its connections to America. We're going to begin with a very, very brief look at a book called Government by Assassination by Hugh Bias, formerly the Tokyo correspondent for the New York Times. We're going to look very briefly at how fascism came to Japan. Essentially, from a hands-on practical standpoint, fascism came to Japan through an assassination program conducted by the Japanese National Security Establishment, relying to a large extent on the so-called patriotic societies, which were actually organized crime syndicates which functioned as extensions of the Imperial Japanese National Security Establishment. Then we're going to delve into an excellent and pivotal book that we've used many times in the past, namely a book called Facts and Fascism by George Seldes. In this book, we're going to take a look at the forces that brought fascism to Japan. Specifically, we're going to take a look at the economic structure of Imperial Japan. We will take a look primarily at the zaibatsu, the five zaibatsu, the so-called family trusts, which dominated Japanese financial and industrial life and continue to do so to this day. The zaibatsu had strong connections, incidentally, to Emperor Hirohito. Emperor Hirohito, although popular opinion has it, he really was sort of extraneous to the Japanese war effort and was sort of a figurehead. In fact, he was the single greatest benefactor of Japanese fascism and imperialism. We're going to take a look at the zaibatsu. We're going to take a look at their role in bringing fascism to Japan, which was pivotal. We're also going to take a look at their connections to big American capital. The zaibatsu, the giant family trusts in Japan, had massive and significant connections to major capital interests all over the world, including and especially American interests. And we're going to take a look at this in a big way. We will, as I said, examine Emperor Hirohito and his connections to the zaibatsu and his pivotal role in profiting from the ravages of Japanese fascism during the Second World War. After we finish that, we, in a sense, are going to jump from the past to the present. And we're going to take a good long look at a couple of articles. We're really going to look again at a couple of articles provided by a listener in which the effects of the decapitalization, I guess one could say, of America under the Reagan administration and their international and political implications are going to be examined. We're going to take a look at just how the Japanese and Germans are in a position to dictate American economic and therefore political policy in the current presidential campaign, and how it appears that they are going to be able to do so for quite some time. This concerns, of course, the fact that in order to finance Ronald Reagan's huge, huge military buildup, the United States has borrowed phenomenal amounts of money abroad, and essentially our government and our economy are being supported by the Japanese and German purchase and holding of high-interest T-bills. Should they decide to unload some of these T-bills, and the unloading by the Japanese of some of these T-bills is being blamed in the recent stock crash in October of 1987. Should the Japanese and Germans take a different view of the utility of these particular T-bills, we are going to be in some very, very deep manure. In fact, we already are. I guess you might say the stench of that manure is going to become a little more apparent to the American people than perhaps it has to this date. There's been a lot of publicity in recent days and weeks concerning the apparently fatal illness of Emperor Hirohito of Japan. again, for those who were not with me at the beginning of the broadcast, the Emperor of Japan's name is spelled H-I-R-O-H-I-T-O. Now, just about all American correspondents that you will hear will pronounce that Hirohito. That is not the correct pronunciation. The correct pronunciation is Hiroshito, sort of as though it were spelled H-I-R-O-S-H-T-O. It's probably a really arcane and perhaps pretentious point, because it's not likely you'll ever hear anyone in this country pronounce that correctly. But for the record, that is the correct pronunciation. Hiroshito, okay? Concerning the illness and projected death of Emperor Hiroshito, an article, a very important article, appeared in the San Jose Mercury News for yesterday, Saturday morning, October 1st, of 1988. This is a story by Lewis M. Simons of the Mercury News Tokyo Bureau, datelined, of course, Tokyo, headlined, Japan Looks Beyond Death of Hiroshito. On the day Emperor Hiroshito dies, a rich and increasingly self-confident Japan will break free of its most obvious reminder of humiliating wartime defeat and begin a new era facing dramatic changes that could lead the nation toward renascent nationalism, excuse me. Even as the 87-year-old Hiroshito lies dying of cancer, discussion abounds that his successor will resume the divine status of emperors that was stripped from Hiroshito by the Western Allies, and that the constitution they imposed will be rewritten. Quote, in our collective consciousness, the majority of our people believe that the emperor is sacred, divine, said Hideaki Kase, H-I-D-E-A-K-I-K-A-S-E, a prominent right-wing author and commentator. Again, quoting, the new era, under the new emperor, will free us from the yoke, the burden of the memory of 1945, and from the national shame that we have suffered. We may be able to revise the victor's imposed constitution and also feel free to realize the true, independent Japanese nation. In recent days, millions of Japanese have discovered within themselves long-forgotten reverence for the imperial institution, which traditionally has been championed by ultra-rightists and Shinto religious leaders. Sales of Rising Sun national flags have tripled, and office workers have put aside bright clothing for somber colors. Local governments have canceled autumn festivals, schools are banning marching bands, and cheerleaders at athletic meets and advertisers are toning down upbeat sales pitches such as Toyota's Joy of Living, unquote. Young couples are postponing weddings, and hundreds of thousands of people have ignored continual rain to make pilgrimages to the Imperial Palace gates where they pray for the emperor. Once the chrysanthemum throne is taken over by Crown Prince Akihito, who is untainted by his father's association with World War II, rightist organizations are planning an extended period as long as 2 years of elaborate Shinto ceremonies involving the new emperor. Their aim is to build a mass popular base for the colorless 50-year-old Akihito and, by direct extension, for a new nationalism. Among other aspects of post-war political life, these ceremonies will challenge, for the first time in 45 years, the loss of the emperor's divine status, mandated by the national constitution, drafted under the orders of General Douglas MacArthur during the U.S. military occupation of Japan. Well, the renascent nationalism, and perhaps one could say proto-fascism, if we look at history accurately, and currently surfacing in Japan, is symptomatic of a larger political phenomenon in that country. In the past on this broadcast, we've looked at a number of disturbing indications that, in fact, fascism is perhaps coming back to Japan. Among the indications that this may be the case, and again that we've looked at in the past, concerns the extreme popularity in Japanese economic literature of Jewish international economic conspiracy theories. There were, as of about a year ago, no less than 12 books on the Japanese bestseller list which attributed worldwide economic control to an international Jewish conspiracy, unquote. This obviously is very, very reminiscent of the doctrinaire anti-Semitism promulgated by Adolf Hitler. In addition, the Japanese have been, or elements in Japan have been making noises defending Japanese involvement in World War II. It has been maintained by a number of elements in recent months and weeks that Japan was not to blame for the Second World War, that it was merely enforcing sort of a Japanese version of the Monroe Doctrine with its East Asia Greater Co-Prosperity Sphere. That was, again, not unlike the Monroe Doctrine, except with the Japanese guarding Asia, much as we pretend to guard the so-called New World for our own benefit. It should be noted also that the fascist elements in Japan were never really removed. I'm talking about the military and political leaders. Many of them, just as they were in Germany, were put right back into place by the Americans in order to, quote, fight communism, unquote. In Radio Free America number 11, we took a look at the fact that the United States kept 80,000 Japanese troops under arms in northern Manchuria alone in order to help fight the Chinese communists. No doubt one of the many factors which ultimately led to the victory of the communist Chinese. Certainly that could not have sat too well with the Chinese people who had endured the rape of Nanking and other outrages. It should also be known that in recent months, anti-black sentiment among Japanese economic leaders has been focused on, and it has been charged and reliably reported that Japanese economic interests who have been investing in American industry have been placing their investments in such a way as to keep them away from large American inner city centers where there are large black populations and have had a minimum of black employees on their payrolls. That is, those companies that represent Japanese or joint American and Japanese capital ventures in this country. Again, the renascent and apparently, at least to a certain extent, resurgent Japanese nationalism and fascism is a source of great concern to any responsible American, because Japan wields such a profound influence on this country. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. However, I think it might be worthwhile to go into something of the history of Japanese fascism in order to understand better just what that phenomenon was, how it came to be, who was behind it, and why it is still very, very relevant for today. We're also going to take a look specifically at Emperor Hirohito's role in the propagation of Japanese fascism, although popular American political literature has it that Emperor Hirohito was largely outside of the war-making machinery and profiteering machinery of fascist imperial Japan. The truth is just the opposite. Emperor Hirohito was the greatest single individual benefactor of the Japanese war effort during World War II. We will discuss that presently. First of all, concerning the rise of fascism in Japan, we're going to take a look very briefly at the Overleaf in a book that describes in considerable detail the assassination program which systematically eliminated the responsible democratic political leadership in Japan and replaced it with fascists and militarists. The book we're going to borrow on very briefly now is called Government by Assassination. It's authored by Hugh Bias, B-Y-A-S, formerly the Tokyo correspondent for the New York Times. The book was published in hardcover, copyright 1942 by Alfred A. Knopf and Company in New York. And on the Overleaf, there is a good summary of the book itself. The book itself is far too long for us to excerpt in the amount of time that we have this evening, so we're going to take a look at the Overleaf, which provides a good, accurate summary of just what this book is about for the most part. Here is the truth about the patriotic murder societies, the army gangsters, the army's idea of Japan's destiny, and the strange role of the emperor. Basically, what this book, before I continue to read the Overleaf, what this book describes is the assassination program which brought Japanese fascism to power. This was executed by the so-called patriotic societies, which in considerable measure were both religious organizations and, at a street level, organized crime syndicates. The patriotic societies, notably the Black Dragon Society, headed up by Mitsuru Toyama, were the focus of a good portion of our discussion in Radio Free America program number 7, dealing with cults. These organizations, which again at one level were actually sort of religious in nature, at the street level they functioned in a very practical way as organized crime syndicates, with all that implies, were functioning at the behest of the Japanese Imperial National Security Establishment as assassins and hommes de main. Continuing with the Overleaf to Hugh Bias's book. In Japan, the army possesses a kind of autonomy which immunizes it from control by any other agency. Long ago, Mr. Bias saw that the intoxication of this immunity would lead to war, and so he spent many years ferreting out from the secretive Japanese how the militarists gained their fantastic power. His book, therefore, is to Japan what Rauschning's Revolution of Nihilism was to Germany. Starting from the grassroots of Japanese politics, it moves steadily toward the amazing disclosure of principles. At bottom, the Japanese army is closely allied with gangsterism. The so-called patriotic societies, which do its dirty work, are nothing more than leagues of murderers, blackmailers, and thieves. Bias shows how these terrorists made contact years ago with certain groups of appreciative younger officers, and how consequently, almost every civilian leader who curbed the army's power was assassinated. This, of course, has two haunting parallels. First of all, as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 10, the rise of fascism in Germany was paved by the assassination program of the so-called Freikorps, or the Black Reichswehr. Basically, underground German army organizations, the Reichswehr, the Einwohnerwehr, and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, collectively known as the Black Reichswehr, originally put together as formal extensions of the Reichswehr, the German army, which then survived illegally to function autonomously, I should say, as extensions of the will of the German General Staff, systematically assassinated the legitimate democratic leadership of Weimar Germany. People like Foreign Minister von Rathenau, Matthias Erzberger, Kurt Eisner, Gustav Landauer, Karl Gereiss, and others, names that should have gone down in history, have been largely obscured because they were dispatched by the so-called Black Reichswehr. The most unnerving parallel is to contemporary America, where even as so-called progressives sit wringing their hands about the fact that we don't have any legitimate political leadership, and maybe we'll have to vote for the Peace and Freedom Party because they don't find Mike Dukakis doctrinaire enough. The fact of the matter is we don't have good leaders because they were all blown away in the 60s and 1970s. We no longer have people like John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and others, because they were assassinated by the U.S. national security establishment. Tragically, even though this is a matter of public record, it is a public record that the American people have steadfastly refused to look at, to their own eventual demise, no doubt. Suffice it to say that assassination is endemic to the rise of fascism. It was in Japan, it was in Germany, and regrettably it is here in America. Now, the Japanese army and the patriotic societies, those religious-slash-criminal organizations, in turn were acting at the behest of the dominant interests in Imperial Japan. Those dominant interests were known as the Zaibatsu, Zaibatsu. Those are the five giant family trusts which ran, for all practical purposes, all of Japan. We're going to take a look now at Japanese fascism, in particular its financial and industrial structure. We're going to take a look at what the Zaibatsu are, how they came to power in a sense, or how they wield their power. We're going to take a look at their connections with American capital, and we're going to take a look at Emperor Hirohito's involvement with the Zaibatsu. And for our information, we're going to rely on a fabulous book, one we've used in the past. That book is called Facts and Fascism. It was copyrighted in 1943, published in hardcover by In Fact Incorporated. The author is a man who is regarded widely as the dean of American investigative journalism. His name is George Seldes, S-E-L-D-E-S. By the way, Seldes' autobiography, Witness to a Century, is a currently available book for people who would like to find out more about him. Again, we've used this book many times in the past, and we are now going to rely on it for our discussion of the structure and evolution of Japanese fascism. Seldes writes in Facts and Fascism in a chapter called The Five Who Own Japan as follows. Fascism, as any study of Hitler Germany shows, has been built up as a system of super colossal robber barons, thanks largely to the international cartels of which IG Farben industry was the largest. Interrupting that, of course, is the giant German chemical trust, the German dyestuffs industry, which we've looked at many times in the past. Continuing. By the way, Uncle Sam and the Swastika and the first two Radio Free America shows go into IG Farben at great length. Continuing. Nationally, all forms of fascism have flourished thanks to the aid the state has given them in maintaining monopolies or trusts. In every instance where businessmen subsidized a reactionary party, whether it was the Fiat works in Italy paying Mussolini, or a landed estate owner bribing a Romanian premier, the party and the most powerful few of the subsidizers have always engaged in forming national monopolies when they took over the rule of the country. Professor Brady, by the way, that's Professor Robert A. Brady, who's a specialist on the economics of fascism in Japan in particular. Professor Robert A. Brady is the only economist who has related the peak associations, or Spitzenverbände, as they were known in Germany, that is, the biggest trade associations, such as the NAM, that's National Association of Manufacturers, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, with the subsidization of fascist movements, and shown how business, whether or not it is officially on the throne, has in all countries become a political power, in fact, the ruling power behind the thrones of fascism. Repeating that sentence again, Professor Brady is the only economist who has related the peak associations, unquote, or Spitzenverbände, as they were known in Germany, that is, the biggest trade associations, such as the NAM and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, with the subsidization of fascist movements and shown how business, whether or not it is officially on the throne, has in all countries become a political power, in fact, the ruling power behind the thrones of fascism. In Japan, the peak associations, unquote, are dominated by the zaibatsu, or four ruling families, who are comparatively more rich, more powerful and richer than the 13 ruling families of America. Excuse me, there are only four zaibatsu. The fifth power here is the emperor. I was misinterpreting the title here. There are only four zaibatsu, and as we're going to see, they're names that are should be very familiar to a contemporary American. Of the zaibatsu specifically, Seldes writes, Japan's financial oligarchy, wrote Anthony Jenkinson for the Institute of Pacific Relations, is composed of great family trusts known as zaibatsu. Its leading members are the houses of Mitsui, Mitsubishi, Sumitomo, and Yasuda. Between them, they own the greater part of industry, trade, banking, and shipping. By 1937, they controlled more than one-third of the total deposits in private banks, 70% of the deposits in all trust companies, and one-third of total foreign trade. By controlling the banks, they controlled the smaller credit institutions throughout the country, unquote. Again, the names of the four zaibatsu, in effect the fifth zaibatsu being Emperor Hirohito himself, as we shall see. The four zaibatsu are the houses of Mitsui, Mitsubishi, Sumitomo, and Yasuda. Continuing with Seldes' account, in 1937, the government brought all the leading employers and business confederations together in the Japanese League of Economic Organizations, which Professor Brady describes as a sort of private national defense council for business enterprise. He concludes, quote, "It would be hard to imagine a much higher degree of policy-determining power than is indicated by the combination of the zaibatsu and its concentric cartel and federational machinery. The hierarchy of business control seems well nigh complete," unquote. The government of Japan and the business interests of Japan are bound together, quote, "from center to circumference," unquote. What is being accomplished is the gradual rounding out of a highly coordinated fascist type of totalitarian economy. Professor Brady points out the fact that it was because the old system of feudalism prevailed longer in Japan than elsewhere that, quote, "The new Japanese totalitarianism has been easier to achieve than in any other major industrial capitalistic country," unquote. The feudal and patriarchal-minded hierarchies of business, unquote, and the political and military bureaucracies were identified and centralized. Government and business are more intermarried in Japan than anywhere else, much more so than in the ruling family of Goering, Hitler and company. But all in all, the fascist pattern is pretty much the same in all countries where wealth and power have taken over the military, economic, political rule. Professor Brady writes that in Japan, the elements, quote, "are not greatly dissimilar to those noted for other totalitarian systems of the general fascist type," unquote. He lists, 1. The zaibatsu, the monopolistically oriented enterprises centered around them, and the extensive network of trade associations, chambers of commerce, cartels, and similar bodies of which they are the acknowledged leaders, constitute an elaborate, semi-legal hierarchy of graduated economic power. 2. The hierarchy works very closely with the civil and administrative bureaucracy of the state. This constitutes the Japanese version of National Socialism. 3. The military is becoming increasingly part and parcel of the same control pyramid. 4. And finally, the psychopathic ideological propaganda cement which holds the Kakutai, the K-O-K-U-T-A-I, corporate state amalgam together in the fused power of Shinto, the main religion, and Bushido, precepts of knighthood. That last sentence again, and by the way, I may know how to pronounce the Emperor of Japan's name really correctly, but some of these names may be wrong. I don't speak Japan, I've just seen that reference in some other books I have. Again, the last item. And this, by the way, should be related very directly to the article we read earlier concerning the impending death of Emperor Hirohito and its political significance for the possible resurgence of Japanese nationalism and fascism. And finally, the psychopathic ideological propaganda cement which holds the Kokutai, a corporate state amalgam, together in the fused power of Shinto, the main religion, and Bushido, precepts of knighthood. Next, we're going to take a look at Seldes' discussion not only of Emperor Hirohito's direct connections to the Zaibatsu, he being actually the main beneficiary of the Zaibatsu, we're also going to take a look at the Zaibatsu's international connections, their connections to the international munitions cartels, and perhaps most significantly for our purposes, their connections to big American capital. Every Japanese gun, bullet, torpedo, ship, and airplane that has killed or wounded an American soldier, a sailor, airman, or marine has meant actual cash money in the pocket of Emperor Hirohito. When the merchants of death, unquote, the armaments manufacturers who had a financial interest in waging previous wars and who still do in fascist dictatorships were exposed in 1934, it was found that Mitsui and Mitsubishi were the Japanese members of the cartel and that the reigning family was a large stockholder in both. Hirohito owns 3,800,000 acres of land with all the buildings on them, many being tenements from which he makes a rent. The total value when the yen was still 50 cents was estimated at 6,637,234,000 yen. The son of the sun goddess has also invested 300 million yen in the Bank of Japan, the South Manchuria Railroad, the Yokohama Specie Bank, Nippon Yusen Kaisha, the shipping line of the Mitsubishi firm, the Imperial Hotel of Tokyo, and the Mitsui and Mitsubishi Enterprises. Next here, Seldes goes on to discuss Japanese participation in the international munitions cartels. Those cartels were front and center in the Nye Committee hearings that were presided over by Alger Hiss, chief counsel to the Nye Committee, and which were inspired in considerable measure by a book called The Merchants of Death, which is undoubtedly the reference in which we saw in this earlier paragraph where, although he doesn't have Merchants of Death capitalized, he has it in quotes. The book is called The Merchants of Death. You can still find it. I've forgotten the author's name offhand. This book inspired to a considerable extent the Nye Committee, and Alger Hiss made a great deal of political hay by distributing this to people. What that book basically pointed out is that in considerable measure, the wars of this century and of the late 19th century have been spurred on by giant international munitions cartels, which have a profound influence in all of the countries on both sides of all of these wars, or all of this world's major wars in the last 100 years or so. Of the Japanese connections to the international munitions cartels, Seldes writes as follows. In the wave of disillusionment which swept over the world after the Treaty of Versailles and proved that the old march of the imperialists would be resumed and that all international idealism, Woodrow Wilson's for example, would be destroyed, many secrets were uncovered, and one of the most sensational was that concerning the international of blood, the cartels of the merchants of death, the armaments makers who made a profit on the guns, the shells, and the bullets. The manufacturing corporations in many instances were found linked to governments and to have arranged, even in wartime, for the continuance of their dividends and distribution of their profits.